What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal points and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know.
Hey, we welcome you to Legal Face-Off, WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. Before we get into the meat of the show and all the topics and the guests, we do have a lineup change. I've been told it's permanent.
Call to the bullpen, yeah.
The winner of the Legal Face-Off host tryout is none other than Tina Martini.
Yeah, yay. Sound effects, applause.
You know her. She's been on Inside Out on this show. She's part of Inside Out, the column with the Chicago Lawyer Magazine. She's a partner at DLA Piper. She's the chair of the Chicago Intellectual Property Practice and the national hiring partner of Associate Recruiting. But now she's a co-host of Legal Face-Off.
Welcome. Much more fun than Jason Whiteside. Actually, I see some papers there, some preparation. So. An odd change of pace.
I take this very seriously.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
How do you feel about your new role on Legal Face-Off?
I'm thrilled.
Media star.
Yeah, maybe, maybe not.
Yes, absolutely.
For our tens and dozens of listeners.
To be fair,
gazillions.
I want to tell a short story. I had to text Rich yesterday and ask who is going to be co-hosting with. And he said, well, it's Tina. It's going to be Tina from now on. So I walk in today, I don't know, 7 minutes before we're about to start taping, and you two are going through a photo shoot. There are photos being taken in the studio, and then the photographer asked me, well, who are you? Are you at the show?
And are you important?
Are you with the show? I said, are you with the show? Who are you?
That was our photographer from Podcast Today, from the noted. No, she. I told her you were coming in, but we didn't tell you apparently to dress up or... Thankfully, you are dressed...
Once every 17 times I dress up.
Normally, it's like a chain mesh, like half top. And
one time, Rich asked me if I just got out of prison when I showed up because I had a beanie, a skull cap on.
Speaking of prison, let's have a moment of thank you for our former host, Jason Whiteside. You know, almost 3 years of Legal Face-Off with Jason.
I miss Jason. I know you're going to keep ribbing him, but I do miss Jason.
He'll be back as a contributor going forward at some point to tell us the
holiday episode.
Absolutely. So welcome, Tina. We're a richer show with your addition.
Thanks, guys. I'm very excited to be here.
Joining us now on Legal Face-Off, Professor Carolyn Shapiro from the Chicago Kent College of Law. She's also the founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States, and a multiple return guest on the show, Andy DeVote, who's a partner at Loeb & Loeb. Thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Great to be here.
One of our favorite segments, Supreme Court panel. You both clerked for the Supreme Court of the United States. Glad to have you back. We want to jump right in now that the term has ended and talk about a couple of significant cases and then your thoughts about a couple issues going forward. First of all, the Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia case. Professor Shapiro, could you briefly tell our listeners the significance of that case?
Well, so this is a case involving a Missouri program where daycare centers and other entities that have playgrounds could apply for a grant to put a playground made out of a surface made out of recycled tires. And the Missouri had a constitutional provision that says that state money cannot go to religious institutions. The church had a daycare center or a preschool. It applied for the funding and was denied because of its status as a church. So this was a pretty significant case involving state or government funds going to a religious institution. And in this case, the court held 7-2, essentially, although there were a number of different opinions, that the state could not deny the church these funds without violating the free exercise clause of the Constitution. In other words, that it was imposing too great a burden on the church's exercise of religion.
So interesting. So, Andy, this court, again, by a 7-2 decision, held that to not give them money would have violated their ability to exercise their constitutional rights rather than finding that this was too much of an intermingling of church and state by giving them these funds.
Right, and I definitely agree with the professor that this case is significant in terms of where we go from here, right? I mean, I think that there's probably reasonable minds can disagree. You know, the final showdown is still to come. I mean, I think to the professor's good point, when you look at the opinions, and there's a number of them, I mean, you would not have Justice Kagan signing on in full, and you would not have Justice Breyer joining, but, you know, he has a very short concurrence where, you know, he tries to shape the scope of how far this opinion reaches. Obviously, that, you know, that'll be for another day, but they're definitely, you know, this isn't the ultimate showdown, but it's definitely a step to the professor's good point that is significant. Then you have other justices who I think are afraid, you know, they don't think it goes far enough, Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch, which I think then goes to the professor's point. So it is significant. You know, there's still a showdown to be had where, again, I don't think you'd have the likes of Justice Kagan or Justice Breyer joining. And it ultimately just, you know, leads to then the question of Justice Kennedy's seat, which I know we'll talk to in a little bit, for that potential fifth vote on an issue like this one.
So, Andy, do you think that this is going to be as broad sweeping as Justice Sotomayor fears based on where we are right now?
You know, I don't think so. I think that, again, it could depend on the court that it comes up in, right? The district court or the circuit court it comes up in, and also the factual circumstances, right? Bad facts make bad law. I mean, you have Justice, the Chief Justice mentioning that, you know, the stakes here in all likelihood were a few extra scraped knees if they don't get the funds. So there were some real efforts to try to downplay and manage the scope. But to the professor's good point, you know, the underlying decision is what it is. And so there certainly is from the decision itself. And then there are some sentences in there that a court that wanted to push it more the way that I think Justice Thomas and Gorsuch would like it to be, and that the dissent fears. I mean, there's certainly material in there for that, but I'd like to think not. I'd like to think that this is going to be something that takes time and, you know, is much more of a showdown when the time comes.
All right, moving on I'm sorry. Go ahead, Professor.
No, I was just going to say that Andy's absolutely right that there was a real effort by a number of the justices to kind of limit the scope of this opinion, and only time will tell if they're going to be successful. There's this footnote in the majority opinion where the chief says, well, you know, this is a case about the denial of funds for playground resurfacing to a church. We're not talking about any other forms of religious discrimination. And Thomas and Gorsuch, who joined the opinion otherwise, refused to join that footnote because right. they think it's too limiting. And Justice Breyer's separate opinion has a similar limitation sort of, implicit in it. So it's really hard to say how firmly that line is embraced by the justices, like the Chief and Kennedy and Kagan, who didn't otherwise comment on it, or how or whether or not it's permeable.
All right, let's move on to the travel ban, because at the end of the term, the court, by a 9-0 decision, much hailed by President Trump as a victory, decided to allow some of the travel ban to stand. Professor Spiro, could you talk about that?
Yeah, so I would certainly disagree with the president's assessment that it was a victory for him.
He's coming on next, by the way, so we'll ask him if he agrees.
Say what he wants. So, you know, there were three justices, Thomas, Gorsuch, and Alito, who would have simply allowed the entire ban to go into effect. But the rest of the court said, no, we think that the ban can go into effect only to a certain degree. And basically what the court did is it narrowed the scope of the injunctions that the lower courts had imposed to make them more neatly match up with the plaintiffs in those cases. So the plaintiffs in those cases were entities like universities and hospitals, and they were also individuals who had family members or close associates who they were trying to have come into the country. And what the court said is, look, all of these people out there who are trying to come into the country and have bona fide relationships with a United States person, so whether a citizen or a permanent resident or with an institution like a job offer or an invitation to speak, the travel ban can't apply to any of those people. So we're upholding the injunction with respect to all those people, and it's just for people who don't have any of those connections that we're going to allow it to go into effect.
All right. Well, that segues into another topic we wanted to discuss with our esteemed Supreme Court panel, which is Neil Gorsuch. We've seen now his handprints here on a few decisions. And as Professor Shapiro mentioned, on the travel ban case, he was firmly entrenched in the conservative wing. He seems to be, just as President Trump promised, a replacement ideologically for the man that he replaced, Justice Scalia. And he seems, both in his writing and in his statements, to be definitely in the Alito-Thomas camp. Andy, as a former law clerk for a very conservative justice, William Rehnquist, what do you think of the way what we've learned about Justice Gorsuch so far?
I think absolutely 100% as advertised. I think, to your point, you look at the travel ban, there's a good example. I think another good example that we were just discussing, that the professor mentioned, the footnote. His footnote, or the reason that he didn't agree with the footnote that Chief Justice Roberts put in the Trinity Lutheran, the religious, what he would call a religious liberty case, you know, it was worried that the holding didn't go far enough. And it will absolutely be the tip of the spear for that portion of the court, pushing religious liberty, just as all the coverage documented, leading up to his confirmation hearings. The cases, Hobby Lobby, the cases that he heard as a judge in the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, I think it's absolutely. And there are other cases, too, in terms of voting on stays of executions, things like that. I think it is 100%, you know, what you saw is now what you have.
Well, and this is a good segue to our final installment of our Supreme Court update, and that is the rumors that Justice Kennedy may be ramping up his retirement within the next year. And we'd love to hear from both of you as to your thoughts on the likelihood that that will happen, given what the current composition of the court is, as well as other justices, including Justice Bader Ginsburg, and what her likely choices will be given where we are right now.
Well, I think that Justice Kennedy is not retiring this summer. Before the end of the Supreme Court term, which was at the end of June, there was a lot of speculation that he might announce his retirement. He didn't. I see no reason to think he's likely to do that anytime now. Until next spring, when the speculation will ramp back up again. You know, I think it's very hard to know. He's not a young man. I believe he's just turning 81. And he has reportedly told at least one applicant for next year, for the 2018 term, that he's considering retirement, which is obviously not surprising. It's impossible to know, but I kind of suspect that matters a little bit what's going on politically otherwise, that if things seem really unstable and chaotic with the Trump administration, he's less likely to retire than if things seem to be more business as usual.
Carl Reiner, noted Supreme Court watcher Carl Reiner, agrees that he should hold on. I don't know if you saw the op-ed yesterday, but Carl Reiner, who's like, what, 95 or something, very well-known actor, said right. to Kennedy, hold on, you know, 81's the new 51. There's plenty of time.
Well, and I think the professor is 100% right that if he were to retire, was going to have retired, he would have, because the justices, regardless of ideology, it really is a family, and a justice wants to give a president as much time, I think, and also the new justice, whoever it would be, just to get the court organized, get things in place, and this time over the summer, the only people we're cranking right now are the new batch of law clerks working on cert pool memos, you know, looking at cases that the justices will be considering to hear next term. And, it was the type of thing that if you look at Justice O'Connor, when she retired, you look at the timing, typically it is right there at the end, so as to give the amount of time. And I think the professor is 100% right about as well that it's just going to be a year-to-year thing. In terms of Justice Ginsburg, I think that we're in agreement here. I think she is going to go as long as she feels like she mentally can do the job. Mentally, she's mentally sharp as a tack by all accounts, you can tell, and it's just whether her physical health.
So to that point, Andy and Professor Shapiro, yes or no, does Trump get a second justice before he's done? Let's assume he's got one term. Does he get one more in the next 3 years?
I think that's likely, but I'm not at all sure who it would be. You know, it could be Justice Thomas.
Yep.
All right, last question. We'll let you go with this. As you've both been in those rooms, you've been Supreme Court clerks. We're always, you know, with our panel, we're always interested in sort of behind the scenes things that go on. You've been nice enough to share some of that. A case like the Trump ban, Bush v. Gore, big cases like that, do they just feel differently? I mean, when you show up for work that day as a clerk and, you know, you check in, do things just feel differently around the court, or is it no different than, you know, a tax appeal case? It must feel different. I mean, you must feel the outside pressure and the media with a case like Bush versus Gore or the Trump travel ban. Can you both address that real quick?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely can tell the difference between those sort of blockbuster cases and the other ones. You can tell on argument day, there's a different energy in the building and in the courtroom, and on the day that things get handed down. I have a funny story about that, which is the year I clerked was the year of the Clinton versus Jones case. And I remember, you know, the court held essentially 9-0 that this lawsuit could proceed, at least under some conditions. And until the court announced its opinion, all these pundits were saying, oh, you know, there's no way they'll allow the lawsuit to proceed. Of course, they'll say the president has immunity. And I would listen to this and I'd think, huh, you know, that's not what the court's going to say, because I knew. And then the minute the court announced its opinion, the same pundits were on the radio and writing in the paper, well, of course the court held the way it held. I mean, who would have thought anything else?
Yeah, and I agree. You can definitely tell. The Michigan affirmative action cases, they had an undergrad and law school case together, an oral argument, and I think every justice asked a question and brought their A game. And similarly, to your point, when opinions are announced, we had the Lawrence versus Texas case, which really set into motion, you know, the events that we ended up with Obergefell last year. And, you know, there were people in the audience, you know, sobbing in joy. And, you know, it is just a different vibe in all aspects of the case.
Thank you so much for your time, Professor Carolyn Shapiro and Andy DeVote. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for having us.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on iTunes. We're also on Twitter. Just search for Legal Face-Off here on WGN Radio. Joining us in studio, Tanya Trish Dawood, who's the Vice President and General Counsel of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you have breaking news, Rich and Tina. They came in to the studio, and they don't know what just happened here.
Play
in
our breaking news sound effects.
Breaking. Dun, 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 dun.
We can't afford actual sound effects on Legal
Face-Off. Take it away, Tanya.
Yes, and so actually, right before I left to come over here, we received word that the appellate court panel had ruled to uphold the existing temporary restraining order.
All right, so backing up, tell us about the lawsuit that you brought regarding the soda tax in Cook County. Give us some background, and then we'll talk about the appeal in a moment.
Sure. So back in November of 2016, the Cook County Board passed an ordinance to establish a tax on sweetened beverages. And it's a pretty large category of products. It includes beverages that are sweetened with sugar, beverages that are not sweetened with sugar, that have all artificial sweeteners. And so, you know, a lot of people refer to it as the soda tax. It's much more than soda. Mm-hmm. And so they pass that tax at a penny per ounce. And so it's a volume-based tax, which is a little different from all the other taxes that we generally encounter. It's really sort of the first of its kind in the county. And it presented a number of challenges for us. We obviously were opposed. And the way that the tax was being rolled out caused a significant number of issues up and down the chain, not only for the retail industry, but for the distributors who also have to pay the tax. And it was going to be very difficult to implement by July 1st. And the reason for that was there were a number of changes that were made by the county in the days leading up to implementation of the tax, and it was going to be relatively impossible for us to implement.
Well, and from what we understand, there are a number of ways in which it's vague. Would you care to elaborate for our listeners on a couple of the reasons why it's particularly vague? And I mean, this is the difficulty, and this is why you're doing what you're doing now. It would be helpful to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, there's a number of cities that already have a sweetened beverage tax, right? Philadelphia has one. Berkeley, California has one. But the Cook County tax is implemented much differently from those. So the tax here is on the consumer as opposed to being on the distributor. And I think that has caused a lot of issues. So one of the things is, because it's a volume-based tax, right, we want to make sure that we're implementing it correctly. Because if we get it wrong, that means that we can be sued for over or under collection of state sales tax, right? So we want to make sure that we get it right. So on the vagueness issue, one of the issues that we identified was, how do we treat fountain drinks that have ice? So because we're supposed to be charging you not on the cup size, but on the actual amount of liquid that's in the cup. And so the county sort of never really gave us a straight answer on that. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that are sort of left up to us to figure out. And those are the kinds of things that we don't think should be left up to us to figure out.
Right.
Did you attempt to work out some of those issues with the county? What was the rush to put this in effective July 1st?
So, you know, like I said, it passed in November 2016. And really at that time, we had identified a number of issues just from the way that the ordinance was written. The rules hadn't even been written yet. And so we said the ordinance itself has a lot of issues. Then the rules were written and there were about 5, 6, 7 different variations of the regulations that came out. And so we were in constant contact with the county saying, hey, listen, we don't think that this makes sense, or you need to clarify this, or you may need to rethink what you're doing over here. But unfortunately, we just weren't getting a lot of traction on getting the changes that we felt that we wanted and, frankly, that we needed. Because the implementation of the tax, originally, the way they were doing it was completely unlawful. They were requiring us to include the sweetened beverage tax into the subtotal, and then you calculate the sales tax from that subtotal, essentially a taxing a tax. Mm-hmm. And we told them from day one, you can't do that. That's a violation of state sales tax law. And we went back and forth, and they said, no, we're on very solid footing here. We're going to treat this just like we treat our liquor gallonage tax, which, by the way, they weren't treating it like they were treating the liquor gallonage tax. And so, you know, we felt as an industry that we had to press the issue. So we contacted the Illinois Department of Revenue and said, hey, this is how Cook County is telling us we have to do the tax. And after some back and forth with the Illinois Department of Revenue, they let us know right around Memorial Day that they were going to issue something official, and it was going to be favorable to our position. And that led to the county, about a week later, after we contacted them and told them that that was coming, to completely change how they were requiring us to implement the tax. And that was on June 1st, 30 days from implementation.
So fast forward to the breaking news that we referenced earlier. You filed suit in Cook County.
Yes.
The judge entered a temporary restraining order, and the county appealed that decision. And now you won that appeal. Where do we go from here?
So we can go a couple of different ways. We can go the preliminary injunction route, which has already sort of been filed. And for us, that would allow the, if it were ruled in our favor, allow the imposition of the tax to be stayed until we get a result and a final result on the merits of the case. We filed the TRO just because we were running out of time, and just that's what we felt like we needed to do. Or we could bypass the preliminary injunction proceedings altogether and just go straight to the merits of the case. So we'll be, you know, speaking with the county about what they would like to do and hopefully come out with something that works for everyone.
So if Tony Preckwinkle, who made this, you know, who was really the driving force behind this, she is the Cook County Board President, if she were here, what do you think she would say? I mean, And also, what is Irma's position globally on things like soda tax? I mean, it's been implemented in many cities that you referenced. Ex-mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, that was a big push for him. He also put some money into this,
absolutely,
into the Cook County issue. Yeah. Do you have an official position sort of globally on the issue?
Absolutely. So we don't like consumption-based taxes, right? Because from our perspective, what they do, we'll just use tobacco as an example. I'm not trying to compare the two products, but we'll use it as an example because it's so incredibly highly taxed on the state, the federal, and the local levels, to the point where, at least in our immediate area in Chicago and Cook, people just, they continue to smoke. They just buy the product elsewhere. So the county, the city, they lose revenue, and someone else gets that revenue. And so consumption-based taxes like the sweetened beverage tax would really sort of have the same effect. People will continue to buy the product, but they'll just go elsewhere to buy it. And frankly, you know, when you're thinking about what products people are buying in the county, you know, a lot of people say, well, no one's going to go, you know, to DuPage County to buy a six-pack of Coke, right? Well, that might be true. But when they think about how high the gas taxes are, when they think about, you know, such things as bag taxes and bottled water tax and all the other things that they have to pay for, pay a premium for in Chicago and Cook, you know, those are the kinds of things that cumulatively, you know, really push people to shop elsewhere.
Thanks for coming in. That's Tanya Trish Dawood from the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. And yes, I am the son of Sam Paniadovich. She did ask on the way in. You know, have you ever heard of him? I'm like, yeah. Only a couple of us in the world.
There
Thank
you,
you for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg Limited for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
We move right along on Legal Face-Off. Joining us now on the phone, he's an attorney at Much Shellis, the law firm downtown, but he's also running for state representative, a Democrat running in the 58th House District in Illinois. He's Bob Morgan, and he joins us now on Legal Face-Off on WGN. Hello, Bob.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Bob, we finally have a budget, sort of, kind of, in Illinois. What are your thoughts on that? That's obviously been dominating the state news here the last several months. What are your thoughts on that?
It's unbelievable, and thank goodness it only took us just over 2 years to get there. And all these social services and schools and all these budget issues are really impacting us in major ways, and it's about time that we finally got together and created a budget that was going to be balanced and get our state back on track.
So you've worked on health care reform, Medicaid expansion, while in state government. First of all, tell our listeners what your background is in state government, and then also some of your ideas on health care reform and Medicaid expansion.
Sure. I had the privilege of working under former Governor Quinn. I was a health care lawyer for the governor's office and involved with a lot of the different aspects of health care reform and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in Illinois that led to just over 650,000 people in the state getting health insurance for the first time. So we've really transformed over the last 7 years now, creating this new expansion of healthcare in Illinois and healthcare policy, just at a time, a critical juncture where the state budget wasn't passed, and at the federal government, we all know they're working really hard to repeal some of these advances that we've made.
So you also have experience, Bob, with medical marijuana. You served as the first statewide project coordinator for the Illinois Medical Cannabis Pilot Program. So what's the latest and greatest with medical marijuana?
Yeah, that's right. I was, in addition to my other responsibilities of other healthcare policy, we created a program just a few years ago, law passed and took effect in 2014, to expand the medical cannabis program into Illinois in a really regulated way, so that these people that are suffering from these really, really difficult, debilitating conditions would have access to this medicine that otherwise they were reverting to opioids and very addictive medications. So really, they were really suffering. So for the last 3 years now, we've had an industry of businesses that were cultivating and then dispensing to the patients throughout the state. We have about 20,000 people in Illinois that would otherwise be using these highly addictive medications that are able to resort to medical cannabis, usually as a second or third option based on all the other conditions they're going through.
Bob, you mentioned implementation of the Affordable Care Act here in Illinois, Obamacare. All we hear coming out of the Sunday talk shows as recently as yesterday, and of course out of the White House, is that Obamacare is a massive failure, and there's lots of different plans to repeal and replace. Do you agree? I assume probably that you don't, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on how the Affordable Health Act has affected us locally here in Illinois.
Sure.
Affordable Care Act, I should say, by the way.
Right. And just because you say something over and over and over again doesn't make it true. You know, I think if you were to really talk to the people in the community that have health insurance for the first time, people that were otherwise going to the emergency room or wondering how they're going to cover their medication costs or decide between having to buy their food in the morning for their family or go buy their medications they badly needed, I think you're going to find a real, real serious personal impact in the way the Affordable Care Act has helped a lot of people. But it's far from perfect. It was never intended to be perfect. It was intended to be a starting point. And unfortunately, because of politics in D.C., we've really been frozen in time as some of the better parts of the Affordable Care Act have gone into effect, but the problems haven't been dealt with because it just politically wasn't a doable situation. So now in D.C., they're trying to shut down the program and just throw out the baby with the bathwater and drop 23 million people from their health insurance coverage. And to me, that's just unconscionable. We certainly have a lot of things that we've done well in Illinois, and we would definitely be struggling in the event of them putting a block grant on Medicaid and cutting off seniors or putting a higher tax on premiums for those 50 to 65. You know, it's a real, real difficult time to think about what happens the day after they repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Switching gears here, we'd love to hear about how your campaign is going so far for the Illinois House seat.
Thank you so much for asking. It's a really exciting time. I'm running in the 58th District. It's up in the northern suburbs of Deerfield, Highland Park, Highwood, Lake Forest, Lake Bluff. So it's a real interesting district that has everything from we have Caterpillar and Walgreens. We also have food pantries and struggling schools. So we really have a diverse community of challenges. And so to hear the ways the state budget has really impacted them, that's really what drove my decision to run. The hearing the way that the state budget was impacting my alma mater, the University of Illinois, and the way that social services agencies and domestic violence shelters were closing down because the state couldn't get their act together. That's what really what drove me to step up and really say, we need to fight for the values we care about as a community. So this is the very early stage. My primary would be in March of next year of 2018. So right now it's sharing a little bit about myself and my values and hearing from the community about the things they're thinking about and really concerned about.
Bob, it's an interesting district because, as you mentioned, it's very diverse. The incumbent is Scott Drury, who has come out, at least, you know, has asserted that he is not a rubber stamp for Mike Madigan. He voted present during the vote to reelect Madigan to a 17th term as Speaker. He's using that, I think, or he will use that as a central theme to his run. How do you feel about that? And how do you give us a couple of points where you would distinguish yourself from Scott Drury?
Well, I think our district in the 58th is pretty independent. You know, it's the same district that sent Republican Mark Kirk to Congress year after year while also regularly supporting Democrats for president and in the state legislature. So it's a diverse district that really is independent-minded, looking at a very thoughtful district that really spends a lot of time looking at the issues. So the state has a number of problems, a number of issues, but our community in particular really focused on education, really focused on federal issues like gun control and gun safety. So it's a really interesting district that's really dealing with these federal and state issues all at the same time and spending a lot of time talking about them within the community. You know, Representative Drury has represented the district now for about 6 years, has represented on the social side a lot of issues that I think we share. I'm a very strong supporter of women's rights and the right to choose. for themselves, and also different issues at the federal level dealing with immigration and a variety of other things with gun safety and things like that. And then state level, there's a lot of different ways you can represent yourself within the House of Representatives, Democrat or Republican. It's a diverse body. There's a spectrum of people from hundreds of miles away all the way up to my district that have a variety of different views. And normally they work together and find a way to get to a solution. And that's what I'm really running to do. I'm running to find a way to build consensus, build dialogue, work with people who disagree with me and those that agree with me to move the state forward. So we're talking about issues in the community right now, everything from we're talking about schools, we're talking about human services and social services funding, we're talking about community care programs for seniors. So there's all these issues that are all bundled up in Springfield, Illinois, and I'm dealing with those every day as I talk to voters.
The website is bobmorganforillinois.com. He's running for the 58th House District for the state rep seat. Good luck on the campaign trail, and thanks for joining us, Bob.
No, thank you so much for having me. You guys have a great day.
Legal grab bag time on Legal Face-Off. We've got seven topics today. Let's just get right to it. The first one comes on the hands of the new budget here in Illinois. It's affected workers' comp.
Yeah, you know, Illinois finally has a budget now after 3 years. Workers' comp reform, as we've covered extensively on this show, was a central component of Governor Rauner's election platform, and he's been trying to institute some changes. But in the wake of last Thursday's decision by Illinois lawmakers to override the veto of a package of budget bills, workers' comp reform was not included in there. There was actually three Senate bills that were voted to override, and there's also three workers' comp bills that were on the governor's desk, but were not dealt with in this package and really won't be dealt with in the foreseeable future. One of them, again, as we covered on this show, was going to set up a state-run workers' compensation carrier. But for now, all that seems dead. So no real progress on workers' comp reform.
Number two on the grab bag involves Charlie Gard, who's a critically ill 11-month-year-old. His parents have been given 48 hours to produce new evidence illustrating how experimental treatment could improve his condition.
Yeah, breaking news today was the appeal or the additional hearing of the court in Great Britain deciding to not allow Charlie Gard to have experimental treatment. His parents were petitioning the court, actually were fighting the hospital's petition to basically remove him from life support. You know, very sad story. This child is one of, I think, 16 kids in the world who have this really rare condition that does not allow him to breathe on his own. He's been in the hospital in London since he was born, basically. And the parents have wanted to take him to the United States or somewhere else to have experimental treatment that, by all accounts, every doctor says, you know, probably won't solve the problem, but, you know, they feel like it's worth a shot. I think everyone can sympathize. The hospital, on the other hand, said that there's really almost no chance of this working. So, they petitioned the court to remove him from the machine. And today, again, as Sam mentioned, was the hearing where they gave the parents 48 additional hours to come up with additional evidence. They said it has to be new and powerful evidence to reverse the earlier court decision.
I think this is a very tough case. I mean, for a whole host of reasons, I think, you know, there is a very slim chance that this child will survive even with the experimental drugs, but there are some folks that believe where there's life, there's hope. And how do you ever progress medicine without having folks participate in trials like this?
Yeah, you know, it's got a lot of attention worldwide. President Trump, of course, famously tweeted a few days ago that they would be delighted, in his words, to have this child come to the United States. You know, very difficult case.
Number three, we'll start with Tina. A wrongful death suit involving tennis star Venus Williams.
Yes. So on June 9th, Venus Williams was in a car accident in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Her car collided with another at an intersection. She went through the intersection and hit this other car. Apparently, both car sustained significant damage. There were two passengers in the other car, a woman, her name is Linda Barson, and her husband, Jerome, who unfortunately died from the injuries that he sustained during the accident. As a result, Linda Barson has filed a wrongful death suit. She sustained a lot of her own injuries in the process of being in this accident. She has a cracked sternum, shattered arm, broken wrist, hand, and fingers. Apparently, Venus Williams was charged as being at fault, but was not cited in the accident, and the accident remains under investigation. Right now, Venus Williams is in the process of playing in Wimbledon and is doing quite well.
Yeah, just won a couple hours ago, advanced to the semifinals, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
The video shows her entering the intersection legally, and then she's cut off by another car, setting off this chain of events that led to the fatal crash with the third car. So, you know, as you mentioned, her attorneys have come out strongly asserting her innocence. I wonder how much of this is, you know, the result of her celebrity status. Certainly the wrongful death lawsuit, you know, they're not going to go after people with who don't have deep pockets like she does.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that they had several witnesses who said that she was at fault in this. So I think there's some conflicting accounts as to who really triggered the accident and who's at fault here. So I guess we'll see what happens with this investigation.
Sam, Venus Williams, 37 years old. Do you think she stands a shot here? How do you think this will affect her her ability to advance to the finals?
I think it works against concentration. And that's the most important thing in any competition, especially at this level when you're playing for, you know, big tournaments with big prizes and all that. I mean, things go wrong in your personal life. Sometimes it's hard to channel that when you get back onto the surface. Some people are better with it. Some people are actually, you know, it ramps up their game. Others, you just don't know. I don't know Venus that well. I've met her once. Not easy to say how it'll affect her career.
Have you covered Serena much?
I covered Serena a couple times. Serena a little better of a player, too. Serena may be the best of all time on the women's side.
Oh,
whoa.
Sam taking the John McEnroe position on the women's side.
She's not the best of all time. She's not. And she admitted that. Let's not even get into that.
Why not? It's called legal face-off.
Okay,
do
what
do
you want
John
me to
McEnroe
start?
McEnroe that
I don't
she
think
would
she's
be
700th.
Even... Yeah.
There are some men she would wax. There are some men she would beat, but there are some that she would not.
Yeah. Tina?
Why is this a gender thing?
It's really not. I mean...
The Billie
I think
Jean
she's amazing.
King, the Billie Jean King, Bobby.
She's so much stronger. Her serves are so much more powerful.
But I also think you have to look at people in the context of the time in which they were playing. And I think, you know, you've got folks like Billie Jean King that were pretty amazing.
Yeah,
granted,
Chris Evert,
yeah,
mm-hmm. Navratilova.
Exactly.
That movie's coming out, Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King, Battle of the Sexes. It looks pretty good.
So we'll you see. Think she's 7-1 in the world then?
I think she's, you know, I mean, the consensus, I'm surprised at the consensus that seems to exist that she would not be competitive with men. I'm surprised. I mean, I think she would be competitive with any man. I don't know. I don't know tennis that well, but mm-hmm. the consensus seems to be from people who know, and I don't think they're sexist. I just think, you know, they know tennis. Consensus seems to be that she wouldn't be competitive, which I'm shocked at because she seems like such a powerful, dominant player that, I don't know, 15th, 20th? I think she would beat like...
700 seems ridiculous,
yeah.
to be honest. It
I
just
agree.
Seems like a slight at her.
Yes, I
That's
agree.
That's what I feel about
yeah.
it.
Well, it's John McEnroe, so, you know.
Number four involves the so-called pharma bro, Martin Shkreli, who's in an ongoing conspiracy and fraud trial, and the feds are now trying to shut him up.
Yeah, so he is wandering around the courthouse, the federal courthouse in New York, literally talking about his trial out in public. He's talking about it in the hallways, and the judge put a gag order on him last week out of concern that he's going to affect jurors who might be in the courthouse. It's going on in Brooklyn, and this is a fairly involved fraud prosecution. And the judge last week, as I said, told him to basically shut up while the court is not in session. He is still live streaming, though. He's on YouTube. I was watching it this morning. He's got a This Week in Investing and Finance live stream on YouTube in which he gives his opinions on which stocks to buy and sell, particularly in the healthcare industry. Shkreli, of course, won notoriety for imposing a 5,000% price hike on a drug used to treat the HIV virus that causes AIDS. So one of the most hated guys in the world, and not helping his cause, I think, by talking about the trial.
Well, and you had asked about how does social media affect the legal profession. This is a great example.
Yeah, no question. Interesting stuff going on.
I like that you bring up that he's not well-liked. He is not very well-liked.
Not at all.
He's one of those people you love to hate, I feel like. That's
well,
why
every
he has
picture
so many
of him
followers.
It's not a nice picture of him. So.
Well, and, you know, I was watching his stream, and he's like in a V-neck and in shorts, and he's playing with his hair while he's talking. He's the guy that just rubs you the wrong way, even if you didn't know that he raised the price of, you know, this drug that would help people.
Number five involves the two articles written by the ABA Journal, the lawyer's magazine, about associates.
Yes. So the first relates to summer associates, which with my hiring hat at my firm is near and dear to my heart. As many of us know, the pay went up for summer associates, but it looks like summer hiring has dropped by about 2% based on an American Lawyer Daily report from last week. 92 law firms responded to this hiring survey, which also stated that first-year law associate hiring is also expected to decrease. This is mainly attributable to feedback that was received that partners in law firms aren't busy enough, which is impacting first-year hiring. I mean, just sort of taking a step back here, I think we've got, as everybody knows, a flat demand in the market. And it's all about stealing market share these days. And the cost of doing business for firms has increased with these pay increases to associates and summer associates.
And so much of the work is going in-house, right? I mean, you host
yes.
Inside Out with David Sussler, who's got the inside counsel perspective. I was just literally at a client meeting in Schaumburg this morning where they hired three in-house attorneys to handle the work that I was, you know, used to be doing for them, which is not great news for my business, but that's the trend. And you understand that because there's such an amount of talent in the market. Why wouldn't you hire someone to come in-house, like a David Sussler,
right,
to handle your stuff internally? There's some stuff that you have to, you know, hire outside counsel for, thankfully.
Right.
But I think the trend is hiring in-house counsel to handle a lot of this stuff.
Yes. And so.
Boo.
Yeah, I know. Boo. Well, I think it's just all about differentiating yourself and making sure that you are able to provide a value add beyond what in-house counsel can do on their own. And so bottom line, attorneys, because we're running businesses, have to stay as productive as possible. And so if there isn't enough work, you don't need to hire as many people.
And then the reason that associates leave, part of that study, or the other study.
Yeah, the NALP survey.
That was really interesting because they said that what I took away was for every 25 new associates hired, 17 other associates left.
Yes. Well, you hope that it's other people, not the same
right,
people that
right,
you
right,
hired
right.
leaving within a year
the turnover
or 6 months.
Turnover is, you know, very tough. Turnover costs between $200,000 and $500,000, according to recruiters.
Yes. And so it looks like associates are leaving. The number one reason is for work quality reasons. They don't want to just do routine work. They want to have a more substantive role and in matter management as well as client contact. Firms often will give their associates opportunities through pro bono and trial advocacy programs to really gain their skills early in their career. But, you know, it's just interesting that work quality was the number one reason cited. And then the number two reason was that they wanted to pursue a specific practice area that presumably their firm could not accommodate them on.
And here was my favorite. Here was my favorite one from that study. Again, this is the Chicago Associate, or it was, I don't know the name of it, but it was a major Lindsay in Africa, which is a big legal recruiting firm. My favorite reason that they came up with for attorneys leaving law firms is... Or the biggest suggestion that they had for to prevent turnover.
I wonder if I bet I know which one you're looking at.
This is the number one. This is one of the reasons that these folks said that you should implement to avoid turnover. You ready?
Stealing office supplies.
Minimize associate contact with difficult partners.
I know.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Number
this is
one,
life.
Isn't every partner difficult?
And number two, clients can be difficult too. This is life. This is the big leagues.
Like,
you got to deal with it.
Is there a separate room at DLA Piper where you put associates that you want to minimize contact with?
Yeah,
like, right. I don't know that that's possible to minimize.
Mom, the partner's being mean again.
Wham.
Number six on the grab bag involves the Fyre Festival, not the Fry Festival, the Fyre Festival.
Fyre.
Which
Fyre.
Was supposed to be a luxury event in the Bahamas. It was far from it, and the founder has not been charged with fraud.
Not Jason Whiteside, by the way.
No.
That's where he is.
Yeah, that's where he is. He's in the Bahamas running bad festivals. So last week, Billy McFarland, who is one of the co-founders of the Fyre Festival, was arrested and released on bail. The co-founder, rapper Ja Rule, has not yet been arrested or charged.
Wait, that might be the most Caucasian way that Ja Rule's ever been pronounced.
One more time. Let's,
wait, the rapper known as Ja Rule... Ladies and gentlemen, Tina Martini.
Favorite Ja Rule song, yeah, go. No.
Okay, Ja Rule.
No, it's Ja Rule. It's Ja Rule.
J-A Rule. J.A. Rule.
No, it's not.
No, you're good.
Stop.
It's short for Joseph Arthur Rule.
Yes.
J.A.
Joseph Anton.
Where were we?
So the festival was set to take place in the Bahamas in April and was canceled due to poor facilities and lack of accommodations. In May, the FBI was investigating the festival organizers, and McFarland was arrested a couple of weeks ago and charged with federal wire fraud for defrauding investors.
Wait, my favorite part of the judge's order was he was ordered to move back in with his parents.
Yes, I don't know.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, I don't know. Is that
possible that the court demands that you sleep in your parents' basement as punishment?
So not only did he have to pay $300,000 in bail, but he had to move back in with his parents.
That's awesome.
So apparently he presented fake documents to induce investors to invest north of $1 million in this whole operation. And
I think if your name is Billy, it's appropriate that you still are exiled to your parents' basement. That's appropriate.
Do we know any Billys? If we had Billys on the show?
Corgan.
We didn't have Billy Corgan. He denied.
That would have been good.
He denied our request.
Ja Rule and Billy. All right. What else we got?
We got one more. Number seven, that wacko, Shia LaBeouf. He's been arrested again on this time a public drunkenness charge. This is the same guy that wanted to walk around and film everything he does for a year.
Yeah,
or so.
late Friday, early Saturday, was arrested in Georgia, in Savannah. Posted $7,000 bond on charges of public drunkenness. He was, I guess, asking strangers for cigarettes. He's there actually filming a movie called The Peanut Butter Falcon. you can't make this stuff up.
With Dakota Johnson. Let's not forget that.
He's got a long history of issues. He was arrested a couple of different times for just weirdness, for just being a weird dude. So Shia LaBeouf's legal problems continue, but... Should we end this with our favorite Shia LaBeouf movie?
Holes.
I mean, besides
Holes. Holes was good.
Interesting choice.
With what was the sidekick's name? Zero? Was it Zero, the little kid? Help me out.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting who directed Holes, Craig Collins. You know who directed Holes? Craig Collins, by the way, co-host of
The Movie Pod? I've heard of it.
That would be Andrew Davis. It all comes full circle. The same Andrew Davis who is featured on The Movie Pod as a director of The Fugitive, directed Holes, Shia LaBeouf's movie.
But his name is Zero. Hector Zeroni. He went by Zero.
Yeah. Also, of course, the first, two Transformers? Shia LaBeouf?
Maybe.
What else is he in? Tina? Any Shia LaBeouf favorite films? He was
Transformers
also,
was good.
Shia LaBeouf was in the first season of that Ben Affleck Greenlight project. You know, the reality show where they were raising or they were... picking a documentarian.
Mm-hmm.
Shia LaBeouf was in the movie that they picked.
And our younger lawyers will say Even Stevens, the TV show. That's what made him famous. Mm. Even Stevens.
What about that?
Even Stevens?
Never seen that, but there was that movie where he was...
Well, that was a television show. Even Stevens was a TV show. It was on... what channel was Even Stevens on? It was on like 2000, 2003.
Nickelodeon or something?
No, the Disney Channel.
Yeah.
Disney Channel. You stopped watching the Disney Channel in like the 90s, right?
No, there's two good Shia LaBeouf movies that we're forgetting. The one where he was like peeping into the window across the way. Yeah, remember he was...
It's a good one.
It wasn't like a porn or something.
The Peeping Tom movie.
Eagle Eye?
Eagle Eye was the other one. Eagle Eye was pretty good.
Oh, that sounds like it could be Eagle Eye.
That was the other one. No, the other one was like...
He was like, he had a broken leg, and he was like holed up in his house. It was a remake of Rear Window, by the way. Like, sort of. It was a modern update of Rear Window, but
and not nearly as good.
Disturbia?
Not as. Yeah, Disturbia.
Is that
that's it?
I mean, I'm just trying to base your descriptions and
just
give the title.
Stay tuned for the review of the Peanut Butter Falcon coming up on.
On
Legal
Dumb Movie
Off in the future. So.
With J.A. Rule as
that's
the sidekick.
J.A. Rule.
That does it for us today. Thanks to Rich. Thanks to Tina. Thanks to Craig Collins. We will talk to you next time. Be locked in on iTunes. You can find the podcast. You can also go to WGNRadio.com. Search for Legal Face Off.